You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, on the incredible drama that took place in the Texas State House last night and early this morning, as well as perhaps we'll discuss the incredibly dramatic change in federal law regarding marriage equality. We'll be talking to Rebecca Traister of Salon.com. And also on the program, discussing the stunning and extremely controversial ruling on the Voting Rights Act yesterday by the Supreme Court. Ari Berman of The Nation will be joining us. It is an amazing news day, ladies and gentlemen. Implications. Very often we talk about the news, and particularly the political news. Undoubtedly, what we talk about impacts people directly, but I don't know that we've had a couple of days like this in as long as I can remember, where so many people will be directly impacted by the rulings of the Supreme Court over the past 2 days, both for better and for worse. Not to mention, if you believe Mike Huckabee, Jesus is crying right now, which is, I guess that means we're going to have a flood? What happens when Jesus cries? Also on the program today, President Obama yesterday gave what was hailed as a major address on climate change. We will talk about what its implications are, not just in terms of CO2 that is put out by factories, new and old, but whether or not, well, we shall read the tea leaves when it comes to the Keystone XL pipeline. You remember, and this almost seems quaint now, that IRS scandal that I was saying is a huge joke of a scandal, and we don't even know what else was supposedly so-called targeted for extra review when it was what groups were signing up for a special tax-exempt status and keeping their donors anonymous. Well, I hate to pat myself on the shoulder simply because I'm at an age now where I could seriously hurt myself by reaching around in that way and pull a ligament. But it seems that those questions have been completely vindicated as the IRS thing collapses. No one is happier about all the news today than Daryl Issa, who doesn't have to look like the idiot that he is. But we will talk about that later in the program. First, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Rebecca Traister.
Last night. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I have want to welcome to the program Rebecca Traister. She is a writer with Salon.com, author of a forthcoming book on unmarried women. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Now, you were one of those people I saw tweeting last night into the wee hours of, or I guess the wee hours of the morning, as it were.
Oh, yes. Quite far into the morning, yes.
What was taking place yesterday? I mean, of course, you know, we'll touch on the implications of DOMA and Proposition 8. But what happened last night, you were just saying before we got on air, was in many respects completely unexpected. Tell us, I mean, obviously the story goes back a couple of years in Texas because we've seen quite a bit about, but just sort of recount to us what's been happening in Texas in terms of the right of a woman to have some measure of sovereignty over her own body.
Well, the things that have been happening in Texas in terms of state law actually are like what's been happening in many states around the country. Individual state legislatures are trying to pass an array of different kinds of laws that essentially make abortion and reproductive care impossible for the women within that given state to get through one way or another. And in Texas's case, also, like many other states around the country, they were doing a bunch of things with this law that was it was a House bill, and then what was being debated last night was a Senate bill. It was being filibustered last night. It was a state Senate bill. And it was a 20-week abortion ban, which would be across the board. It was also a ban that had all kinds of requirements about abortion facilities that basically would have been impossible for Texas's current 42 abortion facilities to rise to these new requirements. And it would force the shutdown of 37 of them, which, of course, makes, you know, as soon as you limit women's access to getting the reproductive care that they need and to getting abortions, you basically make it impossible for them to get those abortions. You're essentially undoing the work of Roe v. Wade. You're preventing Americans, you're preventing women from getting the procedures that they have a right to get in this country that are legal procedures.
When you talk about a state the size of Texas, and you talk about five clinics that provide abortion services, I mean, it's hard to imagine a scenario where you would put up more obstacles to people having access to those procedures. And that was clearly, obviously, the intent of this bill, right? I mean, there's no body of evidence that suggests that the requirements that they were placing on these clinics were necessary from a medical standpoint or a public safety standpoint.
None. To the contrary, what it does is shut down health care, safe, legal health care for millions of women. It is absolutely a detriment to women's health. Of course, proponents for the bill argued for it mostly by claiming that this was about setting up higher safety standards for women and providing safer care. But one of the points that I think Wendy Davis, who is the state senator who did this remarkable filibuster yesterday, one of the points that she made that I very much appreciated her making yesterday, you know, abortion facilities, like medical facilities around the country, and perhaps even more, are so highly regulated already because they're such a political issue. And this kind of concern for we need to have the highest standards of medical health, they're not being applied to facilities that do not only sort of everything from dental procedures and vasectomies to actually live births. Right. We're not asking that hospitals that perform live births, which, by the way, compared to early abortion procedures, are very dangerous. We're not asking that those facilities meet these impossible requirements that will force them to shut down. These are very special sets of too high standards, which are designed to make it impossible for these facilities to remain open.
Rebecca, before we go into the drama of the filibuster yesterday, because it really was an amazingly dramatic event that at one point there were, I think, 175,000 people watching live on YouTube.
In the middle of the night.
At midnight, indeed. But before we go there, I mean, let me ask you this. When we talk about these restrictions, right, I mean, we all know why they're being promoted. in terms of those who want to see these restrictions promoted. We know that audience. That audience wants to see abortion outlawed. They want to see essentially women told they must basically force pregnancies for women. Those of us who can point out, like you've just done, and with an assist from Wendy Davis, that we don't see these type of regulations on any other type of medical procedure, ones that are demonstrably more dangerous to the health of everyone who participates in those. So this is clearly for that purpose. Why is there this kabuki?
I mean, you mean on the kabuki on which part? Why is this presented as for the benefit of women's health?
Yes. For whose benefit is that kabuki theater? I mean, it seems like people are pretty well aware of what's going on here. Either they agree with it or they disagree with it. Why this kabuki?
Well, I think that it's a lot more attractive to say that you're doing this for the benefit of women's health than it is, and which is what many of the bill's proponents say. And it also takes this kind of, even this defense takes this kind of protectionist, paternalistic air. It was really, it was very startling yesterday to listen to the bill's proponents talk about how basically they're just trying to protect the helpless women of Texas. You know, even the disguised arguments about how much these lawmakers want to help women are pretty repulsive in their own right in terms of their condescension, protectionism, and paternalism. But it is certainly more attractive, and these lawmakers know it, to say that they're fighting on behalf of women's health and safety, and the more common argument, which is that they're fighting on behalf of the unborn,
right.
For fetal rights, and in fact are, you know, prizing fetal rights at higher than women's rights. But all that is more attractive than saying what often feels closer to the truth, which is that the fight is actually about policing and patrolling women's reproductive lives and their sexual lives and the way they conduct themselves as independent adults. And that doesn't sound so good in political theater to say, I'd like to continue to control your body and what you do with it, both sexually and reproductively, which in turn has an impact on how you earn your money, how you live in this country, how your social, economic, and professional choices are all impacted by your ability to control your reproductive life. And none of that sounds particularly attractive. And I guess that the feeling is it sounds much more appealing when you say it's about helping everybody out.
Now, I want to get to the drama that took place last night, but I want to start with just, you know, just to edify the point of I just found this bizarre. We have a story of a lawmaker, doing an actual talking standing filibuster in the Texas Senate in what was an incredibly hostile environment, evidenced by what they did to attempt to end that filibuster. But I just have to note this because I just found this absolutely shocking. In the second paragraph of the New York Times write-up of this story, I'm going to quote this. I don't even know how to really sort of like absorb this. The reversal capped a remarkable day in the Texas legislature here. A petite Fort Worth Democrat in pink sneakers staged a 10-hour plus filibuster marathon in which she never sat down. I want people just for a moment just to absorb just sort of the incredible sexism involved in this. What would be does anybody know what kind of shoes Rand Paul wore for those 5 hours? I mean, it's just stunning.
Well, I would like to say that that's better than an earlier New York Times story that I saw about it, in which her name wasn't mentioned until the 16th paragraph. I would like to say that that was the first time story that I read this morning didn't mention the name Wendy Davis, the woman who stood up for more than 13 hours without leaning, without eating, drinking, or peeing, or even touching the podium. And her name wasn't in the initial story that I read. 416 paragraphs. So, I do agree with you. Now, in fairness, I've written a lot about the way that women's clothing and self-presentation is covered by the media. And there is a degree. She wore pink sneakers. The sneakers were symbolic. They stood for the fact that she was going to be standing
right.
For all these hours. So I wouldn't. Yes, you are absolutely right to point to it. And we should consider it.
I just think that if that's the point, then they need to contextualize that. You know, I mean,
yes, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you about that. And I wish, I wish that wasn't the first thing mentioned about her. Let me say that I wish it was, you know, at the bottom paragraph where it was filling in the details. I don't think that's the most important thing that we should have gotten from yesterday's historic reversal, watched by almost 200,000 people in the middle of a Tuesday night. I don't think that the pink sneakers were probably the most important on the journalistic pyramid. But I will say, I do think that there, one of the things I've written about a lot in the past is when you have these women who are still anomalies, there's still so many fewer women in these governing bodies and representative bodies. And there is a way in which when you tell their stories and the stories of the actions that they're taking, their appearance, they don't look like all those who have come before them. And often they don't look like all those that they're opposing on a state Senate floor.
And there's just such a cutesy quality of this. Yeah, she was petite and she, you know, like,
the petite was what got me more than the shoes. She
absolutely
wanted to see shoes. She wanted she wanted people to see the shoes.
Pink shoes, symbolic of what she was doing, is fine in my estimation. But let's leave that aside because that's the least relevant part of this story. So she is into hour, I think it was 12, at about 11 p.m. This is a special session. If she can make it to 12 a.m. to midnight, time will run out. They will not be able to vote on the bill. And then a fellow lawmaker, after attempting to ask her question, get her to cede the floor, comes in with a point of parliamentary inquiry, or basically makes a claim that what she's talking about is not germane. Tell us what happened in that moment, and what that was about.
Well, there was all this tremendous political theater. You know, throughout the whole day, there have been various attempts to get her to violate one of these rules. There are very strict rules for how you maintain a talking filibuster in the Texas legislature, including the no leaning, no sitting, no eating, no drinking, no peeing, no touching the podium, and you had to remain on topic. And so there were, obviously, this was part of political theater. There were people who were trying to get her to screw up so that she could end her filibuster and they could vote the measure in. And at the very end, they got her on a couple of things, including the fact that she had a back brace. Somebody brought her a back brace for all that standing without any sitting or leaning. Somehow they worked that in, and then they got her on two points that they claimed because she had to remain relevant to the discussion at hand. What she had done for the bulk of the day was read testimony sent to her, testimony that was not permitted in the initial discussions of the bill. And she read this testimony about the bill and about the abortion restrictions and about women's experiences with their reproductive care and health in Texas and around the country. She read all that. And at some point, they claimed that her discussion of sonograms, enforced sonograms, which are part of the law, you know, being debated and enacted in states around the country where you force women who are going to have abortions, who want to have abortions, to look at sonograms, to have sonograms against their will, to have the fetus described to them in very graphic terms by a doctor. And she was discussing sonograms, and the claim was that it did not have to do with this piece of legislation and therefore was not germane. This was a completely bogus claim, but it was part of these theatrics and really designed as a kind of a tool of trickery to get her filibuster to stop. And this was actually probably about 2 hours before she was ready to, before it was midnight.
And people and understand that a senator rises, says to the chair, her discussion of sonograms is not germane. What happens at that point is they turn off the audio. She stays standing because she doesn't want to violate anything because they're
right.
A bunch of Republicans huddle at the front of the chamber, presumably maybe some Democrats as well. At that point, it was, I don't know if it was still the lieutenant governor. He made the ruling, I think, essentially that what she was talking about was not germane. Therefore, the filibuster ends. He then essentially exited stage coward and put another guy to stand there and basically take the arguments, the point of inquiries that were coming as people, Democrats in particular, were trying to argue Robert's Rules of Order, that it was germane, that we need to vote on whether or not it was germane, that we need to vote after three so-called violations, whether or not the filibuster can end. This haggling went on for almost an hour and a half.
Yes, and then and there are very moving instances. It's really, people should go back and watch this. The Democrats, who were strategically also trying to run out the clock. I mean, this was all really tremendous. It was a great view of this particular aspect, of a very rare aspect of the American political process, which is a standing filibuster. And the Democrats, her allies, Wendy Davis's allies, were trying to run out the clock, including really moving questions being asked by even some pro-life, anti-abortion state senators who didn't believe in the bill because they were in support of women's health. And then there was this remarkable question asked by Letitia Vandeput.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm saying her name right. She asked a question that was very sort of Bob Dylan-esque. It was probably about quarter to midnight, and she was trying to get herself heard, and she said, you know, how many times does a woman have to raise her voice or her hand to be heard over the men in a representative body? And it was this wildly eloquent question that cut to the quick of so much of what we were seeing more broadly, which was, you know, a predominantly male legislative body trying to shut down and silence women and the rights of women, and literally the voice of this woman who was filibustering. And Letitia Vandeput asked this question, and very soon after, the legislature, the floor, and all the people who'd come, all of the supporters of Wendy Davis, started to shout, and they started to cheer. And it was deafening. And the Republicans were trying to call the roll before midnight to get the vote before midnight. And the cheering and the support from the crowd was so deafening and caused so much chaos that it set the whole representative body into chaos. They couldn't get the roll call called. And it went for minutes. It went for 10 minutes. It went for 15 minutes past midnight. And it was really this had been this one woman talking all day. And then she was joined by her political allies who had her back, and this, you know, State Senator Vandeput, who had, I believe, had just come from her father's funeral.
Yes.
And had come to participate in this, asking this eloquent question, and then to have the participation of the crowd come in at the last moment. And even once the midnight hour had passed, once we had gotten past the part where they were no longer able to take the vote and have it count, Republican lawmakers still tried to get the vote in. They still tried to enter it into the computer, but 200,000 people had been watching, and there was no way that particular last trick could work. And it took several hours actually for anybody to get clear on whether or not the bill was going to pass or not. It turned out that it was effectively killed by this event yesterday. But in some senses, which is wonderful for the women of Texas, though it certainly doesn't end what will be further incursions within that state and around the country. But more than that, the protest that we saw, the effective display of power and resistance to this kind of pushing of laws through, was really important and really historic.
Yeah, we just have a couple minutes here. We're going a little bit long, but this was really dramatic, and that's what I wanted to also is to ask you, is that, you know, 175,000 people, that's not in the great scheme of things, that's not that many people, but
right.
It seems to me that this was such a dramatic moment there, and it has all the elements of drama that you would want: heroes, villains, empowerment, like you say, both in the individual and in terms of within the establishment, the institution, and then also outside of it, literally the people in the gallery preventing this from going forward. And, you know, for a moment, I want to put aside any cynicism I have as to whether or not the Republicans also like this drama, because maybe, you know, it also there's some electoral theories about whether or not they actually want to complete these type of laws in some respects. But put that aside for a moment. This, how galvanizing do you think this will be? I mean, we already have seen in many respects, particularly over the past year or two in our politics, the empowerment as a voting bloc of women, particularly single women, I think, and younger women in a way that, people have projected would happen, but now I think we're sort of seeing it realized. Where do you think this fits in that, saga?
Well, I think that we're seeing our moment find its activist voice, and it happens over time. You know, people often complain that we're living in a politically apathetic moment. But actually, if you look at the past few years, everything from the election of Barack Obama, certainly, the whole campaign, his campaign against Hillary Clinton for the primary, which was historic in so many ways, through the kinds of protests we saw in Wisconsin against Scott Walker's union busing. Now, that turned out not to have been effective, and Walker won that, but the protests still meant something. The protests against the forced ultrasound bill that we saw last year, the rising up against what was called the war on women during the 2012 campaign, happening across the country through states. Now this, the activism we've seen around gay marriage. Now, none of this, it's not all a rosy picture. We also are living in a time of dramatically reduced protections on our rights. Look at what happened yesterday to the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
But I do think that what we're seeing, and part of what was remarkable about last night, is we're seeing it unfold on social media and the internet. You're gaining community. It was basically like a giant protest last night. All these, the eyes of the world were watching. And I think it had things in common with being able to see the televised era of the civil rights era, for example, being able to see what was happening on television. Now we're able to see Texas legislature filibusters in the middle of the night sitting at home in our computers around the world. We're finding our modes of protest in a way that I do think is very powerful, whether or not each individual battle turns out to be victorious. And when it comes to the women, yes, and I am writing a book about single women. Single women were 23% of the electorate in 2012, and they voted for Barack Obama 70% to 30%. They are a massive political force, and you could see that. Not that everybody protesting yesterday was single, and not that everybody was female. But what you see happening around women's rights is very much about an increased recognition that women have the rights to individual life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. It's a defense of reproductive rights that are being encroached upon every day around the country, and it is very tied up with a strengthening idea that women are independent individuals outside of their relationships to men, outside of their relationships to their husbands and their fathers, and that they are not, that they have rights that do not need to be controlled by governing male bodies of any sort. And I think that was part of what we saw yesterday, too.
Yeah, Rebecca Traister, I think I appreciate your taking the time today, and I think I think it's a great point that this not only is incredibly important in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of women's continued struggle for emancipation in these areas, but also I think you're absolutely right to point out that this empowers, this has a broader implication for populist protest, regardless of the issue. And I appreciate your taking the time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. It's been a remarkable few days in this country.
It certainly has. All right, Rebecca Traister, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ari Berman. I spoke to him about an hour ago regarding the Voting Rights Act. We still, of course, have this ruling from the Supreme Court that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, based not only on the fact that the federal government must recognize what the state does in terms of recognizing marriage, but it also, beyond the federalism that is implied in this ruling, it doesn't say that marriage is a state's issue, and that the federal government simply have to abide by what the state says. It says, and I haven't read the full decision, but my understanding is it says explicitly that refusing to recognize a state-sanctioned same-sex marriage would violate the Equal Protection Clause. And so this has broad implications. The falling of DOMA will be followed by, I believe, you will now see grounds in which to contest every state constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage. So this is going to have very broad implications. The failure of Proposition 8 to be upheld was based upon standing. It's a much narrower ruling. It has massive implications for people in California, insofar in the fact that for those people who were married, same-sex marriages that took place for a brief window of time, they will continue to have full standing. But we will see same-sex marriages go forward in California literally, I think, within days, if not weeks, maybe a month or two. But the standing has less implications. And in some respects, the precedents I don't particularly like, but we will talk about that ruling as well. But this voting rights decision is a stunning decision. And Ari Berman expresses that quite well. We're going to take a brief 20-second timeout, and then we will be back with Ari Berman, whom I recorded earlier today. We're going to go long today, folks. So if you're a freebie listener, you're going to get a bit of a bonus today. Maybe I'll make up for it in some other day and shortchange you. But look, if you can afford to become a member at majority.fm, please, we really need your support to continue to do this show in a way that allows those people who can't afford to become members to listen to the show, and also just to be able to bring you what we bring you on a daily basis. So please head over to majority.fm and become a member today if it is within your financial means. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to welcome back to this program the wonderful Ari Berman from The Nation magazine, among other things, also author of Herding Donkeys. And as you heard last week when we spoke to him at Netroots Nation, the author of a forthcoming book on the Voting Rights Act, which was dealt a serious blow by the Supreme Court yesterday. Ari, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. And I guess, unfortunately, I just got a lot of new material for my upcoming book.
Indeed. These 2 days, in fact, have been extraordinary in terms of the consequence of the rulings that have been handed down by the Supreme Court, and frankly, the sort of shocking hypocrisy that has been paraded out by Antonin Scalia. But let's go back to the Voting Rights Act first. It was Section 4 that was struck down. Tell us what that ruling really meant.
Okay, well, the case concerns Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the provision of the Voting Rights Act, the most important provision, which says to states with the worst history of discrimination, primarily in the South, that they have to clear their voting changes with the federal government. So that's the most powerful tool in the federal government's arsenal to stop voting discrimination before it occurs. Now, the way that states are covered under Section 5 is under Section 4. Section 4 was originally written to encompass states where there was a discriminatory voting device on the books, like a literacy test or a poll tax, and there was less than 50% voter turnout in 1964. And that formula allowed them to get the Alabamas, Georgias, and Mississippis of the world who were doing the most discrimination.
And to be fair, the Queens, New York. I mean,
It was also updated subsequently in 1975 to include places that discriminated against language minority groups that didn't pass out, for example, bilingual ballots. That encompassed Texas, Arizona, and parts of some other states, including parts of New York. So the formula originates in 64, and it goes up to the 70s. And what the Supreme Court said was that Section 5 in and of itself, the preclearance mechanism, is not unconstitutional, but that Section 4, the states that are covered under Section 5, is unconstitutional. So basically, Section 5 still exists, it just doesn't cover any states anymore, and thus is effectively dead.
All right. Now, there's a couple of questions I want to get to before we get back to this actual ruling. Under Section 5, for instance, let's just take Texas, because Texas was a prime example of this past year, and I know moments after the ruling, Texas basically said, we're back on terms of our discriminatory voting rules. But in 2011, Texas passed the Texas legislature passed an incredibly draconian voter ID law, which by their own reckoning would essentially disenfranchise 4 to 8% of their registered voters, somewhere between 600 and 900,000 people, approximately, who were eligible to vote but didn't have the voter ID that they would need. It imposed a lot of difficulty on people because sometimes you would have to go 250 miles to get a non-driver's license ID, et cetera, et cetera. So walk me through that. The State Department, I mean, the Department of Justice says this does not pass muster.
Yeah, so Texas did two things. They passed this really harsh voter ID law and made absolutely no preparations whatsoever to ensure that people would actually be able to get that ID. And then they also passed these unbelievably racially gerrymandered redistricting maps that, despite the fact that 90% of Texas's redistricting growth came from minority groups, minorities actually had fewer seats in the new maps than they had before, which is unbelievable. If you look at redistricting, is supposed to account for population growth, and Texas basically did the opposite. They gained all these people and they gave them fewer seats. So the Justice Department blocked both of these laws, both the redistricting maps and the voter ID law. Then the state of Texas had two choices. They could either try to get clearance from the Justice Department or they could go through the federal courts. They chose to go through the federal courts in D.C. The federal courts sided with the Justice Department in both of these cases. They found that the ID law would discriminate against minority voters, and they found that the redistricting maps were enacted with intentional discrimination, which is a very tough ruling to find. And so both of these were then blocked from implementation. Now, without Section 5, what would happen is that intentionally discriminatory redistricting map would be law immediately. The voter ID law would be law immediately. The only way to stop the voter ID law would be to hope for a preliminary injunction. The only way most likely to challenge the redistricting maps would be after years of lengthy litigation, after the maps are already in place, if there's already been elections in place. And so I think Texas is a perfect case study of why we need Section 5, and now we just have basically a third of the country where voting discrimination remains rampant that is now no longer under federal oversight. The federal troops have pulled out like they did after Reconstruction.
Okay, all right. So let me just walk through this now. Now when Texas then attempts to fight the Department of Justice ruling, and they go to court, is the burden of proof different than it would be if Section 5 was not operational? In other words,
yes, well, absolutely, and that's a huge difference. Is the burden of proof is on Texas to prove that their voting changes are not discriminatory? That's another thing that Section 5 does that's so effective. Now, in court, groups, for example, like the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, they're going to have to bring all the proof to show that Texas is discriminatory, which is a much higher bar to clear. So it's very, very, very difficult to win suits under, for example, other parts of the Voting Rights Act, like Section 2, or under state laws for this very reason. Section 5 is the only part of the Voting Rights Act and the only part of federal law that puts the burden of proof on the discriminators as opposed to those who are being discriminated against to have to justify their laws. And that's why it's such a devastating loss, and it's so difficult to find a replacement for it. And so really, I mean, I look at this as the most radical Supreme Court ruling on voting rights since they upheld poll taxes and literacy tests in 1903.
And in fact, that's what Eric Holder characterized the voter ID law in Texas as, basically a modern-day poll tax. All right, so now we should also say that not only is there a legal distinction in terms of the burden of proof, but there's also sort of, at that point, it also becomes a very practical distinction in the sense that it is, you're talking about outside groups having to raise the resources to fight this, as opposed to the federal government doing, which obviously has a built-in apparatus, has expert civil rights lawyers, and has voting lawyers. So there's also some incredible practical implications that go along with both who the burden is on and the level in the terms of the burden of proof, both in terms of a legal sense, but also from a practical sense. So let me ask you this. The AG of Texas, moments after that, and I believe I think it was in Mississippi as well, also said that they were going to reinstitute their laws, which had been struck down through a similar process. The DOJ didn't pre-clear them. In Texas in particular, does that ruling, that voter ID law, still stand, or does it have to be relitigated now because the question is different?
From Texas's perspective, it's like it never happened. So they are just going to enact their voter ID law, groups are going to have to challenge it under other parts of the Voting Rights Act. There's also some question about what will happen with redistricting, because when the federal courts found that Texas had intentionally discriminated in drawing its redistricting maps, they kicked it down to a lower court in San Antonio that's currently holding hearings on that map right now. And so there's some question also of whether or not the maps that were drawn by the court are binding, or whether Texas can just enact the initial maps that it passed, which are incredibly racially discriminatory, and which provide for no new seats for the large and growing minority population in the state. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions here in terms of how this will move forward, but basically, right now, states are just proceeding as if Section 5 never existed.
And just basically waiting for people to come back at them with lawsuits, because the Department of Justice now has no longer any authority to stop them, because all of that is now moot. All right, let's move to the legal reasoning here, because it seems to me that from, you know, afar, you obviously dig into this stuff far, much more. But it seems to me that the court's reasoning was simply based upon a finding of fact as opposed to law. In other words, they didn't find anything necessarily wrong with the apparatus, with the legal framework here. It is okay in principle for the Department of Justice to have a preclearance on some specific states. It's just that they don't like the formula that was developed to determine which states they are. I mean, this is stunning to me. I mean, because the court
jumped in. Yeah,
well,
I mean, it's almost like John Roberts just got rid of the law because he didn't like it. I mean, not because it violated any constitutional principle. There's a piece on Slate today by Richard Posner, a very esteemed conservative justice who teaches at the University of Chicago, who basically says that Roberts is relying on a principle that doesn't exist, which for a very high-profile conservative jurist to say that about the Chief Justice in such an important ruling is really, really, really shocking. And I think if you read Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent, which I encourage everyone to read in the VRA case, she makes it very clear that not only is Roberts totally ignorant of the law's history and its purpose, but that he's way overreaching in what the court should be doing. And we have Antonin Scalia saying today in the DOMA case, well, it's not the court's job to overturn democratically passed laws. Well, look at DOMA. DOMA is a law that even its co-sponsors have disavowed, whereas the VRA is something that's been passed overwhelmingly five times by the Congress, passed originally and then reauthorized four times by the Congress. If there's any law that the Supreme Court should have an incredible amount of deference to, it's the Voting Rights Act. It's one of the most successful and bipartisanly acclaimed laws in its history. So, I mean, I think this is going to be a very very controversial decision, even in conservative legal circles for a long time.
Well, I mean, it should be, because, you know, this is the from their perspective, and by their I mean these sort of strict constructionalists, those people who sort of have a problem with this sort of almost made up concept of judicial activism. They always espouse the notion that in almost every circumstance, you defer to the legislature, that courts should not be making laws in some respect. And this is a perfect example of their tremendous hypocrisy in this case. From the perspective of those of us who believe that the Constitution is more of a living document, that legal principle that you necessarily defer to the legislature isn't always correct. It's less of a conflict. But for them who hold that principle in such high esteem, that's what makes this Section 4, striking down the Section 4, so stunning. Because it seems to me, I don't even understand what the legal principle is that they're arguing. All they're talking about is they don't like the formula. They just think that the formula is outdated. They're sending this back to Congress, and Congress has the ability to make a formula, and we don't know. I mean, have they provided any sort of parameters?
I read Richard Posner writes in this Slate article. He says Justice Roberts was relying on a, quote, fundamental principle of equal sovereignty, end quote, of the states. This is a principle of constitutional law of which I have never heard, for the excellent reason that there is no such principle. I mean, this is unbelievable that I can't emphasize enough. One of the most respected conservative legal scholars is basically telling John Roberts that there's no part of the Constitution that invalidates a law that he just struck down. I mean, this really is like bizarro world that the Chief Justice is relying on. I mean, he's had it out for the VRA for 40 years. I don't know why. I don't know if he got mugged by a black teenager or something when he was 12, and he's had it out for minorities ever since. I mean,
crazy. When you say this, he was drawing up legal memos during his time in the Reagan administration that were unsolicited in terms of how you attack this law.
There's a whole school of conservatives who came up during the Reagan administration. Clarence Thomas was another one of them, who made their mark by challenging laws that they thought benefited improperly minority groups and that included unfair racial preferences. So Thomas was attacking affirmative action. Roberts was attacking the Voting Rights Act. And in 82, when Roberts was a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department working for the Attorney General, he was very strenuous in opposing another part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which applies nationwide. And back then, what happened is the Supreme Court had ruled that you could only show Section 2, you could only prove Section 2 violations if you proved intentional discrimination. So not just evidence of discrimination, but intention of discrimination, which is very, very difficult to prove. It was proven, for example, in the Texas redistricting case, but it's very, very, very difficult to prove. Congress subsequently overrode the court and Roberts and said that, no, you don't have to prove intentional discrimination, just the impact of the discrimination. But if Roberts had won in 82, I mean, there would be many, many, many fewer minority lawmakers in Congress. That whole section of the Voting Rights Act would be weakened. And now, you know, he's back, you know, 20 or 30 years later in a position to just essentially invalidate a law because he doesn't like it, not because there's anything constitutionally wrong with it.
How much do you think, from a strategic standpoint, that John Roberts gave thought to the idea? I mean, because in terms of a story, okay, I think this, obviously, the day after the Voting Rights Act is gutted, We now get these rulings on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, found unconstitutional. It's going to have, obviously, massive social implications across the country. We're going to talk about that in other parts of the program. The Proposition 8 thrown out for lack of standing, a ruling which I particularly don't – I like the result, but I don't like the ruling itself, frankly. But how much do you think John Roberts contemplates? We want to put the Voting Rights Act out ruling the day before the DOMA ruling so that the Voting Rights Act, the utter shockingness of it, because it is, I genuinely think it's shocking, not just in terms of its implications, but this is made up from complete whole cloth. I mean, this is the functional equivalent. I mean, it is the Supreme Court making a determination on fact, which is just conceptually unheard of. The idea that they are making a determination as to whether or not not just that racism still exists, because if they found that there was no racism, there'd be no reason for Section 5, which they found no problem with, but that the way in which the fact finders are finding the presence of racism is somehow wrong. Do you think John Roberts made a strategic decision in terms of when these are released?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Roberts is very strategic about everything he does with the court. I mean, I think that's why he upheld Obamacare. It wasn't because he liked it. It was because he realized that he didn't want to make the court the central issue in the 2012 election and beyond, and he could extract enough concessions, for example, in allowing states to opt out of Medicare, Medicaid expansion, that would make it palatable to some conservatives.
That was also an incredibly bizarre ruling. I mean, the idea that the federal government could have shut down Medicaid for a day and then just relaunched the whole program, expanded, and that would have been okay. That was also a bizarre ruling, frankly.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know quite as much of the details of the health care ruling, but it did strike me as odd. And you know, you looked at the affirmative action compromise. I mean, once I saw that there was this 7-1 compromise on affirmative action, where they kicked it back to lower courts and told them to apply a stricter standard for the University of Texas, I said Voting Rights Act is in a huge amount of trouble. I mean, we already knew that to begin with, but it was clear that Roberts and Kennedy were saving their legal firepower for the VRA. And I want to say, not only Roberts, who I think has disgraced himself, both of the VRA opinion and his dissent in DOMA, but I also think Kennedy shouldn't get off the hook there. Because Kennedy wrote the opinion in DOMA, a lot of people are going to praise him as this, you know, moderate, far-thinking, progressive-minded judge. But he was the one who voted to get rid of Obamacare and who joined Justice Roberts' opinion in the Voting Rights Act case. So I really think that it's a sad day on the court, where there really is no swing justice. There are no moderates on this court. There are some who may, on one issue or another, lean in a conservative direction. But clearly, I mean, this is the most radical Supreme Court that we've seen since the 1930s, and their decisions are having all sorts of impacts, mostly negative, on society. I mean, we had one good day of decisions with the gay marriage decisions today. And then we've just had so many awful decisions, even beyond the Voting Rights Act, all the big business decisions, the fact that the Chamber of Commerce is 13-3 this term before the Roberts Court, that their cases are getting heard at an unprecedented rate. I mean, I think people need to be paying way more attention to the courts, not just the Supreme Court, but the lower courts, than they currently are.
We totally agree on that. Now, I just want to get back to one more aspect of Section 4. Did the court, in basically throwing this back to Congress and saying, learn how to determine whether or not there's racism better, okay? Basically saying, we know better than you as elected representatives, and the literally hundreds of pages of documents and testimony that went into your decision to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act in 2006, was it, or 2007? What did they say? Okay, use these standards, decide within these parameters. In other words, did they give any instruction to Congress on how to measure racism better?
No, I mean they really didn't. I mean, all they said was that that times have changed, but the Voting Rights Act has not. As if it needed to change, and people keep saying, well, now Congress needs to fix it. But I keep saying, well, you can't fix what's not broken. I mean, there was no reason to quote unquote fix the VRA. We looked at this in 2006. The only fix that we would have needed was to go look at the 2012 election, see the outbreak of voter suppression nationwide, and say, okay, maybe we should be expanding the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
That was the only fix that needed to happen.
So, Ari,
instead,
how does Congress deal with this? I mean, you know, even if there was,
I honestly don't think that. I don't know if there is a way to deal with it. I mean, I don't think that they can rewrite the coverage formula based on some other definition and be able to cover the same states. I think the only way you could do it is to look at states. Maybe they had violations in the last 10 years and say you're only going to cover states with violations under Section 5 or Section 2 that occurred in the last decade. Maybe that's a more narrow way of doing it that would be palatable to the Supreme Court.
But
I'm
why 10
sure.
years?
I think it's very likely that they could rewrite the whole formula. It could go back in front of the Roberts Court, and then they could find Section 5 unconstitutional.
I mean, but
I mean,
why?
You know, I don't
why,
know if they're
I mean,
stop
you're,
right
you're right.
here,
I mean,
so I'm not really sure what Congress can do.
I mean, why 10 years? I mean, if Roberts is saying 30 years or 40 years, that's too far to go back, well, then why is 10 years not too far to go back? Why shouldn't it be 15 minutes
well,
ago?
I mean
why shouldn't it be 20?
Well, I mean, I think you could make a more convincing case that was more tailored, though.
I mean, what would also be more tailored would be 6 months ago. Right. I mean, that this shows the absolute fallacy of this ruling is that that it is completely arbitrary and whimsical. If 40 years is not right, well, then you have an obligation to say what is the amount of time in which you can determine. Is it one generation? Is it two generations? Is it three generations? This is the absurdity of this. And it also,
yeah.
I think at one point in his ruling, and I don't mean to get so excited about this, but I'm just shocked by this. At one point, he says that the Voting Rights Act should not be punishment for the past. It should be instruction for the future or something to that effect. And this is what is sort of stunning about this, because this gets to the heart of the id of the conservative mind here. The idea that they perceive this as a punishment as opposed to a mechanism to ensure justice is, I think, a fundamental distinction between which I think is the real tell here. They see this as some type of reparations as opposed
yeah.
to making people and ensuring that people are whole going
no,
forward.
They view it as a debt that was already paid as opposed to something that continues to show its value every single year. And, I mean, that's what Ginsburg in her dissent had to remind the Chief Justice of. She had to remind him first of, you know, Bloody Sunday in Alabama and what it took, people almost dying to pass the Voting Rights Act, and how long it took, 100 years after the passage of the 15th Amendment, which was supposed to guarantee the right to vote for minority groups. And then she had to remind the justice of the fact that the VRA was reauthorized in 2006, both because of the prevalence of second and third generation voter suppression tactics, but also because they made a finding that this stuff was going to continue to occur. And guess what happened? Not only did it continue to occur, but it got a whole lot worse.
Yeah,
that
you made
the
point. The
voter suppression of 2012 was vastly worse than what we saw when Congress reauthorized it, which, if anything, should lead Congress to strengthen the law, not to get rid of it.
In your what I consider seminal piece on the Voting Rights Act that you within the Nation, I guess it was in February of this year, you made a note of Holder noting that there have been more lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 over the past 2 years than during the previous four decades. The aggressiveness in which the attempts to basically unshackle these voting laws, which have been expressly intended in some instances and clearly after the fact shown to disenfranchise a specific group of voters, in other words, minority voters, is unparalleled. I mean, that's what That's what is just so bald-faced about this ruling, I think, Ari. And it's, I mean, obviously, you know this, but it continues to just, I just completely shock me.
Well, and it, the trends kind of make sense, right? I mean, the explosion of voter suppression by Republicans has been accompanied by an effort to kill the Voting Rights Act. I mean, of course, if you're committing so many crimes, you're obviously going to want to try to kill all the cops that are preventing you from doing the crime. And I mean, and so that's really what happened here. And so they go hand in hand. And I've said all along that I believe the GOP's biggest voter suppression target was the Voting Rights Act, that all along during 2012 they had their eyes set on this. The court decided to take this case 3 days after Obama's election. And so, I mean, this is something where there's been 50 years of progress under the act. Clearly the progress has been great but insufficient, and it's going to be very, very difficult to come up with any replacement. I don't think that's a reason for Congress not to try. I think it's very important for Congress to try, both to try to get a solution, but also to keep this issue in the public eye so people are motivated to try to address the problem, either federally or locally. I hate to suggest that Congress address some sort of grand bargain, because we all know how those turn out, but I do think there's just going to have to be some other steps of election reform to try to counteract this thing. Then there's going to have to be some way to get in front of, for example, voter ID laws, early voting, same-day registration. I mean, there's so many components now to election that, you know, it might take some sort of compromise, a guarantee of early voting in exchange for mandating some sort of ID. I'm not saying I'd be happy with that, but I think we're headed to some sort of resolution. Otherwise, it's just going to be incredibly, incredibly messy.
Ari Berman, Nation Magazine, thank you so much for joining us today and the reporting you've been doing on this. It's it really has been amazing. You've been telling us for literally for a couple of years now to watch out for this, and sadly, this day has come. Ari, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM me at Majority FM. Again, if you can become a member, please do. You can become a member at Majority.fm. You can support the show by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link on the front page of Majority.fm. Click it, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon stuff there. You got no excuse for that one. If you buy Amazon junk, buy it through there. We get a little kickback. And also JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% discount. Coupon code Majority. Put it in the coupon box. On the better half, we will talk a little bit about the fall of DOMA and Proposition Hate, as it were. Also, President Obama's environmental speech yesterday. We were teasing it before it took place. He mentioned Keystone, but not in a way that brings me a lot of hope, although some folks are using the way that he framed it as a positive. Hopefully they're correct. We'll talk more about that. Also, the incredible rise and fall of a IRS non-scandal. So much news today. That's just touching the surface. We will take a break. Give us a call, 646-257-3920. Be back in a minute.